This lecture deals with normal tissue responses to radiation. The first radiobiological experiment was thought to be performed by Becquerel in 1901. He used to keep radium in his vest pocket for demonstration purposes, and he noticed that about 10 days after he had removed it, there was a burn appearing. Pierre Curie was interested in this, and he actually reproduced it by putting radium on his arm. The important issue here was the 10 days, because this indicated that it took time for radiation to have its effects, and that this was related to the turnover time of a tissue. This concept of latency, the time that takes for a tissue to express damage, is an important one in radiation therapy, because typically tissues are divided into acute responding and late responding tissues. The difference being defined by the standard 6-week treatment time in the clinic. So acute responding tissues will show the effects of radiation during the course of radiation therapy, whereas late responding tissues will only show the effect afterwards. And therefore, late responding tissues tend to dictate the dose which is given. The importance of the difference between acute and late responding tissues is also seen in terms of the dose fractionation response. So single doses of radiation to late effect tissues tend to be less damaging in the low zone and more damaging in the high zone, whereas single dose effects in acute responding tissues tend to show a much more linear dose response curve. The importance here, of course, is that if you fractionate dose, then you can actually increase the therapeutic benefit of radiation by magnifying that small therapeutic benefit that you see at the low dose area. The distinction between latency and tolerance is an important one. Different tissues have obviously different tolerances to radiation at fail and different times after radiation. So after whole body radiation or abdominal radiation, the gut will fail within a week. Within 30 days of whole body irradiation, then the bone marrow, major dose-limiting tissue. However, the gut, of course, is more radiation-resistant than the bone marrow. So if one is exposed to large whole body doses of radiation, individuals show clinical symptoms within a week, one can fairly safe bet that in fact it's the gut which is giving way. So latency and tolerance are really different issues. Latency is determined by cell tissue turnover kinetics. It's nothing to do with radiosensitivity per se. An easy way of looking at this is to think of the testis, which is a very radiation sensitive organ. It takes about 60 days for a sperm to be produced from a spermatogenic stem cell. So following radiation damage to the testis, sperm counts will remain normal for many, many weeks and then fall precipitously. On the other hand, in the gut, damage will occur much more rapidly. It will occur probably within a couple of weeks, and this is the time taken for epithelial cells to cross the villus and be shed into the lumen. Tolerance doses in the clinic are very, very variable from tissue to tissue, and they also depend markedly upon the endpoint. Some of these tolerance doses are rather empirically determined, not be too precise, but the very variation that you see means that there must be several different mechanisms involved in determining tolerance. One of the empiricisms which is inherent in this, of course, is the perception of the radiation oncologist as to what the tolerance is of a particular tissue. So, for example, in 1998, Paula did a survey of radiation oncologists, and 41% of them felt the tolerance of the spinal cord was between 40 and 44 gray, whereas 24% thought that it was in excess of 50 gray. Does this variation really matter very much? Well, it does. And the reason can be seen in the next slide. Now, this is examples of a mouse gut which have been irradiated with varying doses of radiation. And you can see after 12.5 gray, really there's a little bit of patchy breakdown, but on the whole, the gut looks fairly intact. After 14 gray, there is an even more patchy kind of appearance, and after 15.5 gray, there are discrete nodules that can be seen as the gut regenerates. And in between these nodules, obviously the gut has been denuded, this area has essentially been sterilized. After 17 gray, there are hardly any nodules seen, and the whole area of the gut is sterilized. So over a relatively low dose range, one is seeing what is an acceptable, like go to an unacceptable one, or relatively good histological recovery has gone to something which is really good to be lethal. One can interpret this in terms of the probability of normal tissue damage with dose. And this normal tissue complication curve is really very steep. It's much steeper normally than what you see with tumor control probability curves. You can estimate that there is going to be, in the steepest portion here, in the order of about 7.5% increase in normal tissue complications for an increase in 1 gray. And therefore, an increase in dose of about 20% could cause a large increase in the incidence of complications. Obviously, these complications only occur after you get above a certain threshold dose. But once you are in this area, increase is very steep with dose. There is a formula that can be used to work out the probability of normal tissue complication. There's a degree of uncertainty in it due to the differences in sensitivity of different normal tissues, but certainly sometimes a useful formula to be able to use. One can see the importance of small differences in dose even in the clinic. So one can go from what is an acceptable response within a tissue to an unacceptable one, even within one field. This is an example of an old mastectomy case. I don't think you see this these days, but where you're getting a lot of dose inhomogeneity. This is going from what really is quite a good clinical response on the left to one which is a non-healing response on the right, and this is even within one. It's important to remember that acute responding tissue and late responding tissue respond differently to small changes in dose, and in particular in changes, of course, in dose per fraction. So if one were to decide to treat to a 75% isodose dose line, and in fact that area was treated to a 95%, then you're going to get a physical overdose being delivered. That physical overdose is going to result in a biological overdose as well, and that biological overdose is going to depend upon the tissue. So if it's an acute responding tissue or a tumor which is rapidly proliferating, then the difference between the physical dose and biological dose is not going to be all that large. On the other hand, because late responding tissues are more subject to change with dose per fraction than our acute effect tissues, then when this is a late responding tissue, one might be in fact giving the biological equivalent of 70 gray, where in fact you thought that to begin with you were going to give 50 gray. So tissue tolerance doses are really quite complex, but they can be broken down into a number of different factors which are contributing. Obviously, there's the intrinsic cellular radiosensitivity of cells to repair damage. There's regeneration, which is extremely important. The structural organization of the tissues, the wound healing ability, as well as a lot of non-radiobiological factors. So we're going to go through these one by one, starting with regeneration. This is an example of gut, where you can see that the villi extend into the lumen of the gut, and down in the base of the crypt there is the proliferative compartment. After radiation, you see that the villi become rather denuded of cells, but down in the base you can see the regeneration taking place within the proliferative population. This regeneration is extremely important, particularly for the acute responding tissue. We can follow this in a time course following 10 gray irradiation, which is a relatively modest dose of radiation for the gut. Top left, there's the normal piece of gut, and you see down in the base this blue color, which is caused by hematoxylin staining of nucleic acids, and this is indicative of the proliferative population. Now, 24 hours after 10 gray, you see this blue color is essentially lost as those proliferating cells die because they're radiation sensitive. On the other hand, the villi look relatively normal. Even 48 hours after radiation, the villi don't look too bad. But down in the base, you're beginning to see the start of regeneration taking place. By 72 hours, the villi are very short. The epithelial cells have been lost from there. Down in the base, you see these small kind of morula of regenerating cells which are going to develop with time. But at this point in time, even though there are a lot of cells down there, they are not migrating up the villus. So at this point, one might expect there to be some diarrhea taking place because there's going to be a functional loss of epithelial cells from the villus. By 4 days, there actually is even an overshoot in the crypt repopulation. Lots of proliferating cells down in the crypts, probably more than there was in the original normal tissue. And by 5 days, there is really quite good reconstruction of villi and the crypts. This is to be contrasted with what happens in the testis. Testis, one tends to see relatively little recovery in terms of generation of spermatogenesis. One sees essentially depopulated tubules or tubules which are repopulated to an extent. But in general, one doesn't see a great deal of regeneration within testis. In the skin, regeneration can be evidenced by the appearance of small nodules, and this is 20 days after 15 gray of mouse skin. You can see a couple of nodules coming back again. Withers has worked out that if clonogen survival is higher than about 5 cells per million per centimeter squared, this is sufficient to get good regeneration of skin without the appearance of mouse desquamation. One can also, of course, see this in the clinic, in particular in breast cancer patients. One sees these nodules, really shown on an earlier slide. It's possible to measure the time to regeneration, the extent of regeneration, in other words, the lag period and attribution of regeneration to responses using fractionated radiation. In this particular example, 10 doses of radiation were given. Total dose that was needed to reduce survival to 50 crypts was estimated. And you can see that if these 10 doses are given with a 3-hour interfraction interval, that dose is considerably less than a 12-hour interfraction interval or a 24-hour interfraction interval. And one thinks of the this has been due to different mechanisms which are taking place during the interflexion time period. And the classic example of how this was worked out comes from Elkind and Withers, looking at the effect of dose fractionation on clonogen survival in the gut. What they did was they took a dose of radiation and divided it into two, separated by different interfraction intervals, and you can see that the gut recovered really quite dramatically or if there was a 4-hour interfraction interval, and this was attributed to DNA repair. After a period of in the order of 12 hours as an interfraction interval, there was actually a dip in this recovery factor. This was attributed to the fact that following the first dose of radiation, was cells which are primarily in S and G1 phase left because they were more radiation resistant. And with time, these will move through into the radiation sensitive phase of the cell cycle in G2 and M. And so the second dose of radiation is much more likely to kill them. So one gets a dip in the and then again, as one increases the interfraction interval to a period of 24 hours, one starts beginning to see the effects of repopulation. A way of conceptualizing regeneration is to think in terms of the cell loss factor. Under normal steady-state conditions, every cell that divides, one must die or differentiate, loss to the proliferative, otherwise you would continue to grow. On the other hand, in the fetus or in cancer or during regeneration, this cell loss factor must go to less than one tissue to expand. So one can ask what happens in different tissues to the cell loss factor. So we think that in the gut, which is a rapidly proliferating population, where there's a lot of regeneration that goes on, the cell loss factor essentially becomes zero during regeneration, and you get very rapid regeneration. And this occurs, of course, at the expense of differentiation. There's some loss of function during this period of time when regeneration is going on without creation. On the other hand, in the testis, one sees very little evidence of regeneration, and it seems that the cell loss factor remains at 1. In other words, following radiation, there is a decrease in the stem cell number. As this decrease in the stem cell number results in a decrease in the number of sperm proportionately. The sperm counts can remain low for years after radiation. We think in the skin that overall the cell loss factor becomes about 0.5. It regenerates, but only slowly and often incompletely. What's the relevance of this to radiation therapy? Well, certainly it's highly relevant because one can see mucositis appearing 2 to 3 weeks after the start of the standard radiation therapy course. And this is actually after the initiation of regeneration, which begins about 10 to 12 days. Once regeneration actually gets going, tolerance of the mucosa increases by about 1 gray per day, which is the equivalent to doubling of the clonogenic cell number. So one of the rationales for giving radiation therapy 5 days a week rather than 7 days a week is that this gives time for this regeneration to kick in and the tolerance of the mucosa to radiation. The time between regeneration varies with the tissue, so mouse gut responds very, very rapidly, whereas other organs like the skin and the testis and the kidney really are very slow in terms of regeneration. Obviously, if the start of regeneration is after the end of radiation therapy, then it's less relevant in terms of tolerance dose of the tissue. So for acute responding tissues, regeneration is very important in contributing to the overall tolerance dose, whereas this isn't the case for late responding tissue. So that protracting the overall treatment time beyond the conventional 6 weeks could actually result in even more sparing of acute responding tissue. The downside, of course, is that tumours may also be spared by this increase in overall treatment time. The flip side of this is that if you decrease the overall treatment time to less than the conventional 6 weeks, then one can end up with acute normal tissue reactions becoming dose limiting, and there is good clinical evidence that this is the case. For late effects tissues, treatment time in general has relatively little effect on responses. However, it will be important in terms of retreatment because there can be some regeneration and repopulation taking place in these tissues after the end of the standard course. And so if one comes in again in an attempt to retreat, there are a couple of important parameters involved. The size of the initial dose is important. The initial dose is close to the ED50 value. The remembered dose is high. But if it's less than the ED50 value, for example, in the order of percent of the ED50, remembered dose is low, and one is able to give relatively respectable doses during retreatment. The other thing that's important is the time after the initial treatment in spinal cord. One sees recovery even 100 to 200 days after radiation exposure. The other aspect of tissue tolerance which is of importance is the way the tissues are structurally organized. And perhaps the best way of thinking about this is in terms of functional subunits and the number of clonogens that are required to make up a functional subunit in different tissues. But also how these functional subunits are organized, whether they're in a series or in parallel. All of these appear to be able to affect the overall tolerance of the tissue. By definition, for a functional subunit to survive, at least one clonogen must survive. Think of functional subunits in discrete structures, such as the nephron in the kidney or liver lobule. On the other hand, it's kind of hard to think of a functional subunit with the skin where there is no clear lines of demarcation. However, the concept is an important one and can be one of the major reasons why there is such variation from tissue to tissue in terms of the radiation sensitivity. For example, if you have 168 clonogens distributed in 12 FSUs and you have in another tissue 168 clonogens in 4 FSUs, which is going to be the more radiation resistant and by how much? Well, if you think about it, you have to kind of decrease the number of clonogens to actually sterilize each of these FSUs. So the one on the right is going to be much more radiation resistant. How much more? Well, by a factor of threefold. So the number of clonogens within an FSU can be thought of as something which is going to be important in determining tissue tolerance. Expect, for example, that hair would have a small number of clonogenic cells within the follicle, and so epilation will occur at a lower dose than desquamation. Similarly, you would expect fewer melanocytes in the follicle, so hair depigmentation is going to occur at an even lower dose. So the number of clonogens within an FSU and the number of FSUs is going to be important in determining the overall response of a tissue. As far as a tumor is concerned, of course, this can be considered as being one FSU, because all of the clonogenic cells have to be killed in order to be cured. The other aspect of FSUs that has to be taken into account is how they're arranged. Arranged either in parallel or in series. In lung, we think of them as being in parallel. So if an area of the lung is obliterated, this can have consequences if it's small enough. This is because function is determined by the amount of the tissue that is not irradiated, in other words, the reserve function of the tissue. On the other hand, if you think of a spinal cord where the FSUs might be arranged in series, one can give a high dose to a small volume and this will obliterate that area and this could clinically be very serious. On the other hand, if the cells are relatively radiation resistant, a low dose to a large volume may be enough. This is in fact important whenever you think of volume effects. Volume effects are really quite complex and there are many different reasons for apparent volume effects. Not all of them have a cellular base. But if one thinks of the spinal cord, this is probably a true volume effect based upon cell kill. So, for example, van der Kogel and Hopewell showed that if you decrease the cord length, which is irradiated down to very low areas, perhaps in the order of 2 to 3 millimeters. The dose which is required for myelitis and paralysis is really very high in comparison with, for example, 8 to 20 millimeters. This is different depending upon the end point, whether one's looking at white matter necrosis or vascular damage. Essentially, a similar trend is apparent. So one sees what we think of as a true volume effect within tissues like spinal cord, where the FSUs are arranged in series, whereas within the lung, any volume effect is not really the same kind of concept. It obviously will depend upon the amount of the lung which is irradiated overall. The lung is a relatively radiation-sensitive tissue, provided there is a very large volume which is irradiated. In recent years, it's become popular to think of normal tissue damage in terms of dose volume histograms. This is largely because it's easy to read these off from treatment planning software. And this gives you an idea of volume which is exposed to different doses of radiation. This is quite useful in comparing treatment plans, but there, from a radiobiological perspective, there are lots of potential pitfalls considering these. They're really a kind of two-dimensional representation of three-dimensional data to begin with. There are the possibility of hotspots being hidden. Importantly, it ignores the structural heterogeneity that exists within tissues. The endpoint is important. And the volume, of course, that is being evaluated must be taken into consideration. For example, bladder surface is going to be much more important than the whole bladder. So the effects of changes in dose volume histogram will vary with the tissue, with the structure, organization of structure of the tissue, physiological reserve, and many other factors. So dose volume histograms hide a lot of complexities. There is another way of looking at the structural organization of tissues relevant to radiation, and it's quite a useful one, although the distinctions are somewhat false. One can consider tissues as being organized as hierarchical, flexible ways with a hierarchical organization composed largely of stem cells and progenitor cells and differentiated cells. Whereas in the flexible tissues, the proliferation can take place linked to the function. So in hierarchical tissues, differentiated cells tend not to proliferate. As in flexible tissues, functional cells can be induced to proliferate on demand. And this tends to tie into differences between acute responding tissue and late responding tissue. So hierarchical tissues are rich in stem cells, proliferative progenitor cells. They have a high turnover rate, a high rate of cell loss. They're largely acutely responding tissues. And the latency appears to be largely independent of the dose which is given. It's not completely true, but it's close to being true. And so these tissues fail largely through a radiation-induced deficit in the stem or progenitor cell populations. Flexible tissues, on the other hand, have a slower turnover rate. They stem cells, progenitor cells. The functional cells, on the other hand, to proliferate on demand. Whenever this happens, they are going to proliferate, and because of the radiation-induced damage within these cells, they're likely to die. And on dying, they're likely to send out signals which induce more proliferation, so this can result in an avalanche effect. Avalanche effect is that as dose increases, so will the latency decrease. So here's an example of mouse spinal cord where it sees dose-related changes in the latency of radiation-induced myelitis, which are really fairly dramatic. Late effects are, I think, perhaps more complex in many ways than acute effects. One of the reasons for this is that there appears to be a healing response involved in many late effect responses. Late effects can actually be considered as dysregulated or failed healing. So whereas in for example, gut damage, one can see relatively high dose of radiation, one gets almost complete recovery tissue. With late effects, one sees a much more complex type of ulcer. And in fact, there is a kind of continuum, at least in time, between acute effects and late effects. So, for example, in the skin, you can certainly see evidence of both. You get erythema occur very early on, your kind of lysis reaction 1 to 2 weeks after 6 gray. Desquamation can take place with re-epithelization. And then months to years after radiation, one can see another series of effects, which include erythema, atrophy, fibrosis, necrosis, telangiectasia. And these late effects are somewhat variable in incidence, but certainly serious late complications. One thing that should be noted about late effects in general is that most of the assays which one uses for late effects are really functional rather than clonogenic. Don't really have many good clonogenic assays for late responding tissues. The exception is the kidney in the mice. One can see 15 months after irradiation, you get extensive loss of cells from the tubular epithelium, but within some of these tubules you can see really good regeneration taking place, and this regeneration appears to occur from one single surviving clonogenic stem cell per tubule. So the late effects seem to evolve with time and unfold with time. For example, in the lung you can see two major waves of late effects, pneumonitis and fibrosis. In mice there's a strong genetic element as to whether they display either pneumonitis or fibrosis. In the brain, one sees a variety of late effects, including white matter necrosis, edema, hemorrhagic necrosis, atrophy. All of these are variably found following radiation and at variable time points as well. And in some situations, one can see quite apparently fairly discrete single types of lesions. For example, this is a monkey spinal cord 15 months after 22 gray. It shows demyelination of the long tracts as the outstanding lesion. This kind of white matter necrosis is due to loss of oligodendrocytes, which are responsible for the myelination effects. The late effects involve processes which are inherent in wound healing, and that is responses driven by cytokines and growth factors. And these cytokines and growth factors really drive tissue regeneration, not only in late effect tissues, but also acutely as well. The interesting thing about these kind of responses is that they can also be responsible for some of the pathogenesis of complications and some of the symptoms that patients see, for example, fatigue, erythema, somnolence and nausea. All of these can actually be caused by cytokines and growth factors. And these may be responsible for these type of side effects more than, for example, cell death would be. One should know the kind of major classes of cytokines and growth factors in the body. Three cytokines like TNF are particularly important in many types of responses. Angiogenic cytokines like VEGF and basic fibroblast growth factor. Physiological cytokines are very numerous, but IL-2 and IL-4 are the two kind of basic examples of these. There are cytokines that drive fibrosis, and this is obvious importance in radiation because radiation-induced fibrosis is a common complication of radiation exposure. And TGF-beta, FGF are important fibrotic cytokines. And then there's a large number of growth factors which are responsible for proliferation of the hematopoietic system, the colony-stimulating factors. And also other cell types within the body, for example, epidermal. So what really are cytokines? Well, they're soluble factors that seem to drive this crosstalk between cells and tissues. And they coordinate tissue responses to damage. Their aim really is to heal damaged tissues and restore homeostasis. Following radiation, cytokines can be expressed very, very rapidly within us. And then over a period of time, weeks, months even, there is this kind of cyclical change in cytokine levels within the tissue. One thinks that complications arise whenever the regenerative process, which is driven by these cytokines, is unsuccessful. So following mouse brain irradiation, if you look at like TNF-alpha, for example, you see these cyclical kind of responses with time which go on. And these can be important in terms of symptoms which the patients might have. It's also important to realize that they can drive cellular responses. So TNF, for example, will drive gliosis. It can mediate demyelination, and it's certainly important in edema, in radiation-induced edema within. One can see these similar kind of cyclical changes in cellular subpopulations within the brain, for example, in oligodendrocytes. This leads to the conclusion that the cytokines are driving these types of responses. And again, it's important to realize that these are occurring during the latent period before one sees any major complications of brain irradiation. However, they can certainly be important in some of the more motions, for example, somnolence, fatigue, and mental confusion, and so on. Radiation-induced fibrosis is obviously a common complication, and TGF-beta is the pro-fibrotic cytokine par excellence. It causes fibroblast differentiation, senescence, and production of collagen. This is important in many ways, I think, fission damage. For example, Mitch Hancher has shown many years ago that patients who have high persistent serum levels of TGF-beta before and during a course of radiation therapy for lung cancer have a higher risk of developing uterus. Some of this TGF-beta might be being produced by tumor as much as by radiation normal tissue, but certainly is a compelling kind of TGF-beta is activated within the irradiated site. It's this activation process that leads to collagen deposition. Now we think of TGF-beta also as driving a process which is also driven by other cytokines in a kind of coordinated fashion, which involves fibroblast senescence. In other words, instead of fibroblasts continuing to proliferate, following radiation, they are driven into a post-mitotic phenotype. This post-mitotic phenotype is the one that gives rise to fibrosis commonly. So cytokines can also be important in many other ways in addition to this kind of tissue. Cytokines delivered either exogenously or produced endogenously can even affect the intrinsic radiation sensitivity of cells and tissues. One thinks that cytokines that activate cells to undergo cell cycle progression and survival tend to be radioprotective, whereas if they inhibit these processes and if they induce apoptosis, then they will tend to steer cells towards radiosensitization. So one thinks of cytokines as changing the microenvironment within tissues in important ways, affecting endogenous radiation sensitivity of cells, being involved in cell proliferation, tissue remodeling, really the radiation effects as being consequence of a failure of a wound healing process. One of the more positive aspects of the involvement of these factors in late effects is that it might be possible to actually intervene to modify them. The old days, it was certainly true that late effects were considered once to be progressive, irreversible, very difficult to manage. But with time, there has become a change in this concept, and there's a large number of different drugs and strategies which are on the modifying late effects. Most of these have been tried in preclinical models rather in the clinic. So there is an interesting trial by Galenian using pitoxifilin with vitamin E patients and looking at radiation-induced fibrosis and showing increasing rates of response with time after treatment. One thing that is important to realize with respect to normal tissue responses, in particular late effects, is that there's a genetic element involved. This from preclinical studies. We know that genes are involved in inflammatory processes and regenerative processes are important. Clinic, it appears that the number of fibroblasts that survive 2 gray radiation can actually correlate with late effects. In recent years, there's been several studies which have looked at single nucleotide polymorphisms in patients and their association with radiation-induced late effects. So in conclusion, there are a number of important issues which have to be considered whenever one's irradiating normal tissues. The time to a normal tissue complication depends upon the tissue turnover time. This is relatively independent of those for hierarchical tissues, but not for flexible tissues. Association between latency and tissue tolerance is really non-existent. Some tissues which are radiation sensitive and fail late, there are some tissues which are radiation resistant and fail late, vice versa. But the time and the extent of regeneration that occurs in normal tissues is important in determining how much dose can be tolerated. And this is particularly true for acute responding tissues, which are actually proliferating and regenerating during the course of a normal fractionated protocol. Tissue tolerance depends upon a number of factors, not only the regeneration and the intrinsic radiation sensitivity of the clonogens, but also on how these clonogens are organized into FSU. And the number of clonogens per FSU. This can be important in terms of volume effects, but volume effects are really quite complex and due to many different kind of causes. But the major cellular volume effect is really thought to be differences in FSU organization. The role of cytokines and growth factors in all of these normal tissue responses is thought to be fairly critical. This is, in as far as acute effects are concerned, cytokines and growth factors are primarily involved in regeneration. But as far as late effects are concerned, they are also involved in healing response, results in consequences such as radiation-induced fibrosis. And so these cytokines and growth factors can be important in determining the pathogenesis of some radiation effects that are clinically induced.